WJZ-FM HD2 Catonsville.
Bloomberg 99.1.
Programming paid for by Bloomberg.
Now, an update from our partners at ABC News.
From ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The president's acting attorney general sent to Capitol Hill for damage control as a growing number of Republicans object to President Trump's $1.8 billion fund of taxpayer money that could give payouts to political allies who claim that they were targeted by the Biden administration, including January 6 rioters. It didn't go well.
Republicans demanding answers or they won't approve more funding for the president's immigration crackdown. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche scrambled to Capitol Hill, even suggesting that senators could claim money from the fund themselves. But sources tell us the meeting backfired spectacularly. Some Republican senators screaming at the acting attorney general, saying the president's fund could cost them the midterms.
ABC's Mary Bruce. And tonight we're hearing from former Republican leader Senator Mitch McConnell, saying in a written statement, quote, "So the nation's top law enforcement official is asking for a slush fund to pay people who assault cops? Utterly stupid, morally wrong, take your pick." House Republicans pulled a vote on an Iran War Powers resolution that members were slated to vote on tonight. Sources telling ABC News a vote was scrapped at the last minute due to attendance issues on the GOP side. Hurricane forecasters with the National Weather Service are expecting a below-average Atlantic hurricane season this year. Lead hurricane season forecaster Matt Rosenkrantz.
So our forecast for 8 to 14, when average is 14, right? So we're at or below that average for named storms. And for hurricanes, it's 7. And our forecast is this year is 3 to 6.
The season runs from June 1st through November 30th. And in San Diego today, more than 2,000 people gathered to mourn the three victims of Monday's shooting outside the Islamic Center, including staff who delayed two suspected teenage attackers and prevented further bloodshed inside the center at a time when children were at the school. Record close on Wall Street for the Dow today, up 276 points. You're listening to ABC News.
Now, your three-day weather forecast on Bloomberg 99.1.
Unsettled weather likely over the next couple of days as we've suppressed the heat and humidity off to our south and east. Cooler air up in Canada working its way in. That's going to cause a frontal boundary to stall out, and it's going to act as a highway for showers and storms to move up from the central part of the country through our area over the next several days. Clouds night, there'll be some showers around. We're 50 to 55. Showery and cool tomorrow with a high of only 60 to 65. Passing showers in 50 to 55 tomorrow night. The weekend not looking much better. Showers are likely Saturday. There could be a passing thunderstorm. It stays cool, 60 to 65. Showers on Sunday, a high of 75. Memorial Day, we're cloudy and warmer. There'll be some showers and maybe a thunderstorm. High temperatures Monday afternoon, anywhere from 75 to near 80. I'm Rob Carolyn, and that's your Bloomberg holiday weekend forecast. Now back to the latest headlines from ABC News.
A new report from the Democrats breaks down why they failed to beat Donald Trump in the 2024 election. ABC political director Avery Harper.
It's pretty brutal, a brutal evaluation of DNC leadership and those who were around President Biden and the lead up to 2024. It says that Harris wasn't properly prepared for a presidential run, that Democrats relied too heavily on anti-Trump messaging, and that they took key voting blocks for granted.
U.S. health officials now defending their decision to divert an Air France plane to Canada to prevent a passenger from entering from Congo. ABC's Steve Osunsami.
What should have been a smooth trip from Paris to Detroit turned into panic halfway through the flight on Air France. Authorities were telling the pilots that they couldn't land in America because one of their passengers was from the Democratic Republic of Congo, the new Ebola hot zone. The plane continued on to Detroit Wednesday evening without that passenger, but other people on the flight say they're not sure who it was and worry the rest of them may have been exposed. Canadian health authorities say that the passenger from the Congo was showing no symptoms and was unlikely to spread the virus.
Two-time Cup Series champion and NASCAR mainstay Kyle Busch has died at age 41. His passing comes just days after he was hospitalized with a severe illness. In a statement released by the Busch family, he will be remembered for his sharp wit and competitive spirit that sparked a deep emotional connection with race fans. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Markets, headlines, and breaking news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, Bloomberg Television, and the Bloomberg Business app. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
From Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York, I'm Doug Krisner. Let's update top stories. We'll look at market action as well. Comes down to geopolitics. Today, Iran said the latest U.S. proposal partly bridged the gap between the warring sides. However, at the same time, Iran's supreme leader reportedly, according to Reuters, issued a directive that the country's near-weapons-grade uranium should not be sent abroad. And we also heard from Iran's president, who said his country will never back down and cannot be conquered. Also today, we learned that Iran is in talks with Oman on creating a permanent toll system for maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. That's according to the Iranian ambassador to France. Now, President Trump rejected the idea, and we heard from U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
Well, we've always said a tolling system in the Straits would be unacceptable, but we don't just say that. The world has said that. We have a resolution right now in the United Nations. We're trying to take it to the Security Council. It's sponsored by Bahrain. It has over 100 something in it. The highest number of co-sponsors in the history of the Security Council have signed on to our resolution.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Crude oil prices in New York trading fell, with WTI dropping 1.9%. However, now during Asian trading, WTI is up 1.5% at 97.80. U.S. Treasury yields are right now holding steady after finishing the New York session somewhat mixed. The 10-year was down 2 basis points to 4.56, and the 2-year added about 2 basis points to 4.08%. We're pretty much at those levels now in the Tokyo session. The Dow Industrial Average managed to close at a record high, 50,285, with a gain of 0.5%. However, Dow component Walmart fell more than 7% after the company said rising fuel costs are squeezing its bottom line, and that could lead to higher prices for shoppers. The Trump administration is awarding $1 billion to IBM to build a foundry for producing quantum computing chips, and today IBM shares were up 12%. Ralph Lauren reported revenue and profit above expectations during the regular session. Ralph Lauren shares were up 13%. We check markets for you throughout the day here on Bloomberg. Right now in Tokyo, the Nikkei is up 2.2%. In Hong Kong, Hang Seng rising 0.7%. On the Chinese mainland, CSI 300 also higher by 0.7%. And in Seoul, the Kospi ahead by 0.3%. Global news, 24 hours a day and whenever you want it, with Bloomberg News Now. I'm Doug Krisner in New York, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Law.
Congress can have no say in making an office independent.
I think all agencies need a degree of autonomy.
It really tests whether the amendments to the law have teeth.
Interviews with prominent attorneys and Bloomberg legal experts.
Joining me is constitutional law professor David Super, Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr.
And analysis of important legal issues, cases, and headlines.
Apple's a walled garden. They don't license their technology.
That is a valid basis to dismiss the case.
Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso. Ahead in this hour, the Supreme Court dismisses a death penalty case on defendants with mental disabilities without making a decision. January 6th, police officers sue to stop Trump's $1.8 billion so-called anti-weaponization fund. And what's behind the indictment of Raul Castro?
We are announcing an indictment charging Raul Castro and several others with conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals.
Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche unveiled murder and conspiracy charges against former Cuban President Raul Castro before a cheering crowd in Miami. Castro, the brother of late revolutionary dictator Fidel Castro, is accused of ordering the downing of two small civilian planes operated by the exile group Brothers to the Rescue, killing four people 30 years ago when he was Cuba's defense minister. The indictment does fuel speculation that the U.S. is preparing to launch military action against Cuba following the capture by U.S. forces in January of former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to face drug charges in New York. Blanche appeared irritated when asked if the indictment will be used as justification to send forces into Cuba.
We didn't indict. This isn't a show indictment. This is an indictment because we expect that there was a warrant issued for his arrest. So we expect that he will show up here by his own will or by another way.
And today, Secretary of State Marco Rubio refused to answer a question about how Castro will be brought here to face the charges.
Well, I'm not going to talk about how we're going to get him here. If we were trying to get him here, why would I say to the media what our plans are about that? I know you have to ask, but why would I answer that?
Joining me is former federal prosecutor Nima Romani. He's the president and co-founder of West Coast Trial Lawyers. Nima, tell us about this indictment.
The Raul Castro indictment is significant in so many ways. I mean, something that, frankly, we really haven't seen before this administration. Obviously, you know, Manuel Noriega, but you have now the second head of state or former head of state who has been indicted by this administration or arrested by this administration. And typically, there would be no world legally or politically where it would even be possible for Raul Castro to ever step foot in an American courtroom. But of course, with President Trump, he can be unpredictable. So there's certainly the possibility that this arrest warrant is actually executed and he does face trial for these murders some 30 years ago.
The acting attorney general said this is not a show indictment. But isn't that what this is in many respects? I mean, Cuban opposition leaders in Florida have long been urging U.S. officials to bring charges against Castro. Trump has been threatening military action in Cuba ever since U.S. forces captured Maduro. A grand jury in Miami brought the indictment on April 23rd, but the government waited to announce it until Wednesday, about a month later, on Cuban Independence Day. And this is 30 years ago. Has the evidence been growing, unlike every other case where the evidence gets weaker over time?
June, I can tell you I've been doing this 25 years, and I covered the DOJ press conference live, and I can tell you I've never seen so many cheers and applause at a Department of Justice press conference. I mean, this is a big deal politically for Cuban Americans. I obviously am not naive to the harm and suffering that them and many of their family members have endured by, you know, the brutal Cuban government. But, you know, I think one of the questions that was raised repeatedly during the press conference to Todd Blanche, the U.S. attorney there in the Southern District of Florida, and the Florida attorney general, it was a who's who of prosecutors there in Florida and throughout the country, all of whom were praising President Trump, of course, was, is this a symbolic indictment? An indictment doesn't mean anything unless prosecutors can actually get across the finish line, get a conviction, put someone in prison. And we've seen this Department of Justice have, you know, some pretty high-profile starts, but they haven't gotten anywhere, right? It can be to Shames, it can be Comey, I mean, you name it. Now, this is something that's even more challenging. And I think Blanche had a tough time answering that question because, frankly, it's really not within his control as the acting attorney general. This is something that would require military intervention. There is no world where Castro is coming to the United States voluntarily. And similarly, there's no world where Cuba is going to extradite him. I can't imagine that that's even possible politically. So the question is, will there be a military operation? I think before Venezuela, I would have been very skeptical, but obviously that was something that in many ways was unprecedented. Again, the only other example would be Noriega. So it's certainly possible, but are they going to go arrest a 94-year-old and try him? I think that would make a lot of people here happy politically, but without some sort of military assist legally, I think, unfortunately, this isn't going to go anywhere.
Well, Blanche said, quote, "We expect he will show up here either by his own will or another way." I think another way most people see as a military operation similar to the Maduro operation. Cuba's current president called it a political maneuver fabricated to justify the folly of a military aggression against Cuba. I mean, it seems almost blatant.
It does. And to answer your last question, I think it's an important one. You know, what's changed in the past 30 years? You know, is there a smoking gun that, you know, in the past year and a half, this new administration, they found new evidence? No, I mean, these cases get worse over time, right? If you're looking at how you would prosecute it, you need someone on the inside to testify that it was Castro's order to shoot down these planes. The MiG pilots, co-pilots, I mean, you name it. It would require some sort of cooperator testimony. One of the pilots, I believe, since died. And I can't imagine that anything has changed in terms of the facts of the case or the law. What's changed is, obviously, you have a president who is willing to be very aggressive when it comes to these types of charges and potentially even more aggressive when it comes to military intervention. And I think that's what's changed. The politics has changed, not the facts and the law.
Talking about the politics, this is an example of the administration using the Justice Department to bolster its own aims, in this case, foreign policy aims. But we've seen this time and time again, this use of the Justice Department for President Trump's ends.
Yeah, no question. Obviously, I mean, the DOJ has helped Trump and his family members in terms of going after his adversaries to protect him. This is one of the main criticisms of the DOJ. Is this Department of Justice there to serve the American people and the public, or is it there to serve the president? And I think serving the president is a problem. Now, of course, folks on the other side will say it was Biden who started it, and the weaponization, the lawfare, and we'll go back and forth. I think what makes this unique is that you have the DOJ, which rarely, but here appears to be serving a foreign policy objective. I recognize that there are many people in Florida and elsewhere that support this from a foreign policy, international relations perspective. The question I have is our federal court system the best vehicle for something like this, right? I'm not so sure. And it hasn't been historically. But I can tell you, like, my parents moved here from Iran when they were in college, you know? So there are a lot of people in the Iranian-American community that feel a certain way about that government over there and would be, you know, dancing in the street if, you know, one of the Ayatollahs were to stand trial here in court. And, you know, I believe that many of them are war criminals. It just, this is not typically what is done in the DOJ to be extraditing heads of state. And I understand he's a former head of state and the immunity doesn't apply. Again, it's just not how it's typically done. But obviously, when it comes to President Trump and our legal system, you know, you can't say never. Every day, there's something unprecedented, and this is certainly one of them.
I think it sets a bad precedent, the U.S. indicting foreign leaders and then using military operations to go in and bring them to jail in the U.S., using the legal system to bring about regime change. But there's no exit strategy, whether it's Venezuela, Iran, or perhaps next Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Venezuela and Iran. So Venezuela, again, you know, I spoke to many Venezuelans immediately after Maduro was arrested. I mean, they were elated, you know, and I think it was symbolically, it meant a lot. We'll see what happens with the prosecution itself and if he is convicted. But I wouldn't necessarily say a whole lot has changed for the people of Venezuela, and notwithstanding that, you know, important symbolic prosecution. Iran, I would certainly argue that at least for the Iranian people, the war hasn't been very helpful. It may have been helpful for the U.S. and some of our allies in the Middle East, potentially. Again, I'm no foreign policy expert. But again, you know, I think, June, you and I have spoken many times. I think we really need to separate the law from politics. And there appears to be no separation whatsoever anymore, which is such a big problem, in my opinion, because the last thing you want is for people to be prosecuted because of their political beliefs or for international disputes that should be resolved through diplomacy or the UN or even the ICC. What's going to happen? We'll have a tit for tat where, you know, we have China and Russia and other folks who are indicting or charging, whatever the equivalent is over there, you know, American political leaders. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Nima. That's Nima Romani, president of West Coast Trial Lawyers. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show. The Supreme Court dismisses a death penalty case on defendants with mental disabilities without making a decision. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by listening to our Bloomberg Law podcasts. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And attorneys, looking for legal research? Whether you're an in-house counsel or in private practice, Bloomberg Law gives you the edge. With the latest in AI-powered legal analytics, business insights, and workflow tools. With guidance from our experts, you'll grasp the latest trends in the legal industry, helping you achieve better results. For the practice of law, the business of law, the future of law, visit BloombergLaw.com. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Get the news you need to start your day in just 15 minutes.
The latest on efforts to end the war with Iran.
President Trump's summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Wake up with Bloomberg Daybreak U.S. Edition.
New concerns about aviation safety.
Darren Judd, yet another home run.
Available now on your podcast feed.
Each weekday morning at 6 a.m. Eastern.
The changing of the guard at Apple.
Subscribe to Bloomberg Daybreak U.S. Edition today on Apple, Spotify, and everywhere you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Radio.
Context changes everything.
This is the Bloomberg Money Minute, another game changer in the weight loss drug industry. Nearly half the patients who received a high dose of Eli Lilly's latest next-generation obesity shots lost about 30% of their body weight. That's on par with what you'd lose through riskier bariatric surgery. On Wall Street, stocks rose and oil fell on signals that Iran and the U.S. may be closer to a deal to end the conflict. The Dow today up 276 points, closing at a new all-time high. The Nasdaq up 23, the S&P added 13, and oil now close to $97 a barrel. On the eve of a scheduled trial, Meta Platforms joining TikTok, Google's YouTube, and Snapchat in reaching an undisclosed settlement in a landmark lawsuit alleging student addiction to Instagram and other social media platforms upended learning and pushed in public schools to spend enormous resources to fight a mental health crisis. And the Spanish fast fashion chain Zara launching a 150-piece collection of pants, shirts, and more with the pop star Bad Bunny. Tom Busby, Bloomberg Radio.
Now, your three-day weather forecast on Bloomberg 99.1.
Scattered showers tonight. A few rumbles of thunder are possible as well. Lows in the District of Baltimore, 50 to 55. Showers cool tomorrow, 60 to 65. Scattered showers tomorrow night. Lows are 50 to 55. Showers on Saturday. Chance of a thunderstorm, 60 to 65. Scattered showers are possible on Sunday, 75. Showers Monday, 75 to 80. I'm Rob Carolyn with your holiday weekend forecast on Bloomberg 99.1.
Stacey Vanek Smith here from Everybody's Business. This week on the podcast, we talk about Amazon.
How do you frame Amazon today? It's so many disparate things. And we write, it's a corporate turducken. Turduckens are always funny. It's an ad business, a logistics company stuffed inside an e-commerce marketplace, trust to a cloud computing powerhouse, garnished with Alexa, Whole Foods, and Prime Video.
Listen to Everybody's Business from Bloomberg Business Week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready or not, summer is coming, and Wayfair's Memorial Day clearance is on now. Right now through May 25th, get up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus, score amazing doorbuster deals all sale long and surprise flash deals on Memorial Day. We're talking thousands of products at every style and budget. Now is the time to save big on must-haves for your patio, backyard, and beyond. These savings won't last, so don't wait. Shop Wayfair's Memorial Day clearance now through May 25th.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Bloomberg Radio, on demand and in your podcast feed.
On the latest edition of the Bloomberg Business Week Daily Podcast, a conversation with Kurt Wagner, Bloomberg News senior technology reporter, on Meta laying off thousands of employees as part of an AI restructuring plan.
Once you are publicly traded, that $1.4 trillion you're spending on infrastructure is suddenly weighed against very public numbers around your revenue, your profits, things like that. And so, you know, to date, OpenAI obviously is making the bulk of its money from subscriptions for its AI products. It's dabbling in advertising. But as we've seen from Meta over the last couple of quarters, you know, simply having a massive advertising business doesn't, cocoon you from the criticism of spending aggressively on AI. So I think OpenAI is going to hit this reality at some point very soon where people are going to see that they're spending a lot, but the revenue is minuscule in comparison. And we'll have to see how investors ultimately react to that.
Yeah, Kurt, I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about how the two companies compare and contrast, like how they use AI, because obviously Meta has been around for such a long time, and we all know the Meta business model. We've all known this company for so long. They didn't start as an AI company. OpenAI clearly becoming a company in the age of artificial intelligence.
Well, what's interesting is the two are trying to kind of get into each other's swim lane here. So in Meta's case, obviously they're an advertising behemoth and have been doing this for more than 20 years, more than $200 billion in revenue last year, almost all of that advertising. But they're, you know, just rolled out their first sort of closed LLM and talking about potentially selling subscriptions to that.
Hear the full conversation on the latest edition of the Bloomberg Businessweek Daily podcast. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Plus, listen anytime on the Bloomberg Business app and Bloomberg.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
The U.S. Supreme Court won't rule for now on how state courts should analyze the results of multiple IQ tests when determining if death row inmates have an intellectual disability that would bar their execution. Today, a divided court dismissed Alabama's bid to be allowed to execute a convicted murderer who was found by lower courts to be intellectually disabled. The appeal was dismissed as improvidently granted, an unusual action that leaves the last lower court ruling in place. Joseph Clinton Smith has been on death row roughly half his life after his conviction for beating a man to death in 1997. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals halted Smith's execution, and that decision will now remain in place. My guest is Greg Block, a professor at Georgetown Law. Greg, tell us about the issue in this case.
So in the background hovers profoundly different visions of the death penalty. And I think that be remiss if we don't acknowledge the intensity of that difference of perspective. In the kind of medium foreground is an opinion issued more than 20 years ago, Atkins versus Virginia, which held that a person who, to use the argot of the time, was mentally retarded, to use contemporary language, a person who was intellectually disabled, which held that a person in such a state who had been convicted of a capital offense and sentenced to death could nonetheless not be executed consistently with the Eighth Amendment to our Constitution. That led to the question, it posed the question, of what constitutes mental retardation, as it was called back then, or intellectual disability, as it's referred to up today. And there have been multiple approaches to that question. Central to these approaches has been the role of intelligence testing, which dates back 120 years and yet is still, you know, au courant, a pervasive part of our lives. We're all familiar with the IQ test. We're all familiar with its first cousin, the SAT, the Scholastic Aptitude Test, et cetera. So this is not stuff that is unfamiliar to, you know, most Americans. And medicine and clinical psychology have approaches to diagnosing intellectual disability that do involve some use of the IQ test, but also involve clinical assessment, subjective clinical assessment, which is rooted in part in people's history, their school history, their behavioral history, et cetera, and rooted in part in the onset of various forms of apparent disability. And that approach contrasts with the use of just the number, the IQ test. And even if we use just a number, if people take multiple IQ tests, they get different results, because the IQ test is not measuring some inherent biological phenomenon like you might measure the amount of hemoglobin in a person's blood. The IQ test is assessing people's behavior on that particular test. And IQ, contrary to what lots of folks might think, is not an inherent, you know, thing that exists in the same sense as the amount of hemoglobin in someone's blood. And so we have dispute over how we should count multiple varying IQ tests. And I'd say, above all else, this fight that led to this case, which was now being dismissed as improvidently granted, but with lots of vociferous reactions on the part of four different justices, really six, counting the concurrence and the dissent. This fight is about whether medical and psychological experts, clinicians, should render that final judgment about mental disability, or whether the courts should issue an approach, whether the Supreme Court should issue specific guidance for how mental disability should be determined for the purpose of whether somebody should be put to death.
And did the state of Alabama basically want to use an average of the defendant's IQ scores?
Basically, the state wanted to use the IQ scores without the subjective process of clinical assessment. Now the state accepted that there might be more than one approach to thinking about multiple IQ scores. And there were, I believe, if I remember correctly, four or five different IQ scores flowing from tests administered at different points in time, and most recently from tests administered by psychologists working for both the defense and the state. So you can average the IQ scores. You can, as the state suggested, take the highest IQ score. You can look at the error ranges that each IQ score offers up, and you can count perhaps the lowest possible IQ based on the error range. There's lots of different approaches, and the state did not vigorously insist that one of those approaches had to be the correct approach, but the state did take the position that it should be just the IQ scores, not the expert's clinical assessment.
And this appeal came from the 11th Circuit, which is quite a conservative circuit, that had halted Smith's execution, finding that he met the intellectual disability standards set out by the Supreme Court in Atkins, based on the results of multiple IQ tests administered over several years.
And you could view this result today as a kind of functional affirmation of the Court of Appeals.
So what they did was, it's called a dig. They said that the case was improvidently granted, meaning right. The justices made a mistake by agreeing to take it up.
I don't claim to be a professional court watcher, but that's a term of art. There's lots of terms of art. Just like if one judge disagrees with another and gets the votes to win, that's called, you know, an error. Does it really mean an error as in a mistake? Well, not really. That's a term of art. And same thing here with improvidently granted. The Supreme Court, has a variety of maneuvers that it can engage in order basically to say, well, we're not going to decide this particular issue now, at least the way it's already been framed, or we're going to let this percolate in different kinds of ways. And that's the move that the court made today.
Because this case had already been before them, didn't they know what they were getting into?
One never knows, you know, within the secretive, well, I guess they're not quite as secretive as they used to be, the chambers of our Supreme Court. Things do leak occasionally, and perhaps 20, 30, 40 years from now, historians will go through records and find something interesting about how this result came about. But at this point, we can't really know.
I mean, it seems unusual that you had, you know, this improvidently granted, but yet there are 62 pages of opinions. I mean, right. When does that happen?
Right. It's usually the two-liner per curiam, right? You have that two-liner per curiam, but the PDF says then 60-some pages.
Do we go by what Justice Sotomayor said in her concurring opinion?
I think what we can say is that the court is collectively telling us through its vociferous disagreement that under circumstances that might well arise in the near term, it will again consider this issue. But for now, for whatever reasons, it's going to hold off. Now, we could take Justice Sotomayor literally here and infer that once a record in some future case lays out additional findings, additional alternatives from experts, additional arguments as to how the question of mental disability should be determined, that the court will be more willing to hear the case. There is an interesting precedent for this, June. If we go back to 1986, we have the opinion Ford v. Wainwright, in which the Supreme Court did hold that executing somebody who was not mentally competent to be executed, didn't understand because of psychiatric illness why he or she was being put to death, was contrary to the Eighth Amendment. And when the Supreme Court issued Ford v. Wainwright, it notably failed to issue criteria for mental competence for execution. And to this day, the Supreme Court has not issued such criteria, leaving lower courts, both state and federal courts, to the task of making those determinations, perhaps inconsistently. So yep. It is interesting. We now have both for so-called insanity or mental incompetence, I should say, and now for cognitive disability, intellectual disability, we have the Supreme Court not providing specific guidance.
I mean, do you think it's better in a case like this that they don't provide specific guidance?
Yeah, it's a pretty profound question that you've just posed, because here we have something ineffable, something intangible, something ambiguous and uncertain, and that is this question of mental disability. Mental disability severe enough so that we deem it contrary to the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution to execute somebody in this state. That's a pretty vague concept, however specific the court tried to be in Atkins versus Virginia more than 20 years ago. And then the question arises, who decides this ambiguous thing? And of course, since it's ambiguous, and since it's literally a matter of life and death, there's a whole lot of morality involved, a whole lot of, you know, what people think ought to be done. Right? And who should decide the ought here is the central question. Who should decide the ought? And the experts, under the model that was pursued by the district court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals, experts are the ones who get to decide the ought. And so if you're a critic of the experts should decide view, you know, as, say, Justice Alito is, you might fairly say, well, that means that experts are interpreting the Constitution and that we have psychologists or psychiatrists deciding what constitutes an unconstitutional execution. You know, there's nothing in the Constitution that says physicians or psychologists are, you know, authorized interpreters of the document, right? And if you're a supporter of the vision laid out by Justice Sotomayor, and if you're critical of Justice Alito in this regard and Justice Thomas, then you say that by denying experts this role, we're denying our best answer to the question. But it is ultimately a moral question, where that line is, how we define that line. And it's ultimately a political question, dare I say this, whether we want to look to the clinical community, psychologists and psychiatrists, or whether we want to look to judges to define this line.
And Justice Thomas's dissent is no surprise.
Thomas is clear in his dissent that he's about getting rid of Atkins versus Virginia. He's declaring a war on Atkins versus Virginia. Whether he wins that fight someday, who knows? That's a guessing game I'm not going to engage in. The more important dissent here is the Alito dissent, which has multiple co-signers and is focused on this question of who decides where that line is, and weighs in heavily in favor of the courts deciding rather than the clinical community of experts.
Thanks so much. That's Georgetown Law Professor Greg Block. Coming up next, January 6th police officers sue over Trump's $1.8 billion so-called anti-weaponization fund. This is Bloomberg.
World markets, headlines, and breaking news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com and the Bloomberg Business app. This is Bloomberg 99.1. Now, an update from our partners at ABC News.
NBC News, I'm Dave Packer. Republicans are pushing back on President Trump's planned $1.8 billion fund to give payouts to those who claim they were targeted by the Biden administration, including January 6 rioters. North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis.
These people don't deserve restitution. Many of them deserve to be in prison. This is just stupid on stilts.
House Republicans pulled a vote on an Iran war powers resolution that members were slated to vote on tonight. Sources telling ABC News the vote was scrapped at the last minute due to attendance issues on the Republican side. President Trump putting on hold an executive order that would allow the government to evaluate AI models before they're released, saying he's postponing the order because he fears it would block the technology's advancement. A sudden reprieve for a death row inmate in Tennessee. Tony Carruthers, a triple murderer, strapped into the execution table, but officials unable to find a vein. The governor saying the state will now not try again for at least another year. This is ABC News.
Markets, headlines, and breaking news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, Bloomberg Television, and the Bloomberg Business app. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
From Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York, I'm Doug Krisner. Let's update top stories. We'll look at market action as well, beginning with crude oil. In New York trading, prices drifted lower after Iran said the latest proposal partly bridged the gap between the warring sides. That on the positive side. There were a few negatives, though. Iran's supreme leader reportedly issued a directive that the country's nuclear-grade uranium should not be sent abroad. And we also heard from Iran's president saying his country would never back down and cannot be conquered. At the same time, we learned that Iran is in talks with Oman on creating a permanent toll system for maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. This is something that President Trump has rejected. Right now, crude oil in the Asian session trading higher, with WTI up 1.3% at $97.65. U.S. Treasury yields very little changed here in the Tokyo session. We were mixed at the end of New York trading, with the 10-year losing about 2 basis points to 4.56. We're trading 4.57 now. The 2-year was up about 2 basis points to 4.08%, and we're holding at that level now in the Tokyo session. Tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. Wall Street time, President Trump will be hosting a swearing-in ceremony for Fed Chair Kevin Warsh. The Trump administration today awarded $1 billion to IBM to build a foundry for producing quantum computing chips. IBM shares were up 12% today. The Pentagon is weighing whether to scrap a conditional loan offer to the rare earths refiner ReElement Technologies. It's worth $80 million. Now, back in November, the Pentagon announced this deal. It was part of the administration's multi-billion dollar drive to develop domestic production of rare earth elements. However, since then, officials vetting ReElement Technologies have raised doubt about the company's ability to scale its technology. Right now in Tokyo, the Nikkei is higher by about 2.3%. In Hong Kong, Hang Seng up 0.7%. And in Seoul, the Kospi rising 0.4%. Global news 24 hours a day. This is Bloomberg.
Now, your 3-day weather forecast on Bloomberg 99.1.
There'll be a few showers around tonight. There may also be an isolated thunderstorm. We're going to be 50 to 55. We'll have showers and cool weather for tomorrow. Highs only 60 to 65. Showers are possible tomorrow night. Lows are 50 to 55. Showers and Saturday, watch for a thunderstorm, 60 to 65. Showers Sunday, 75. Showers Monday, 75 to 80. I'm Rob Carolyn with your holiday weekend forecast on Bloomberg 99.1.
Bloomberg This Weekend. News, politics, and the lighter side of Bloomberg.
The great wealth transfer includes $570 billion in classic cars.
I'm not in a position to be inheriting any classic cars. You?
No, but my brother did inherit my non-classic car when I moved to New York, so.
Ooh.
He still has not paid me for it. Coming for you, Joey.
Bloomberg This Weekend. Saturdays and Sundays starting at 7 a.m. on Bloomberg 99.1. Bloomberg Television. And the Bloomberg Business app.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to Singapore on July 22nd. Our fifth annual Asia-Pacific Summit will explore how business and finance leaders are shaping the next phase of globalization by strengthening resilience, advancing climate adaptation, and driving a multi-speed energy transition across Asia's diverse markets. Join us for solutions-driven discussions, interactive workshops, and networking opportunities. Learn more at BloombergLive.com/SBS-Singapore.
When your car is making a strange noise, no matter what it is, you can't just pretend it's not happening.
That's an interesting sound.
It's like your mental health. If you're struggling and feeling overwhelmed, it's important to do something about it. It can be as simple as talking to someone or just taking a deep, calming breath to ground yourself. Because once you start to address the problem, you can go so much further. The Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council have resources available for you at loveyourmindtoday.org.
This is a Bloomberg Money Minute, another setback for the current spring home selling season. Mortgage rates now at the highest level since August, averaging 6.51% according to Freddie Mac. Rising hopes for a diplomatic end to the war in Iran and a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz sent stocks higher today, despite some mixed signals on both sides. But that hope was enough for the Dow to close at a fresh record high and oil to close a little bit lower. At the closing bell, the Dow up 276 points, half of 1%. The Nasdaq added 23. The S&P was up 13 in oil, closing a little above $96 a barrel. Cosmetics giant Estee Lauder calling off merger talks with the Spanish makeup company Puig. That sent shares of Estee Lauder sharply higher in late trading. And Google temporarily halting service of its Waymo robo-taxis in Atlanta. That's over concerns that those cars may attempt to drive through flooded roads like one did in San Antonio last month and was swept